This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome back to Science with Dr. Carl. My name is Lucy Smith, and I want to start this episode by saying thank you. Thank you to you for listening, liking, subscribing, engaging, because in June, we recorded our highest audience number on record. This is a segment that's been running for a really long time, a podcast we've been doing for a while, and to know that y'all are still tapped in is really exciting. So thank you so much. We also have guests that join us every now and then. And this week we had Zoe Keane, who got into a bunch of different questions. We learned about water cremation. We learned about different topics that scientists aren't really seeing eye to eye on. And do koalas have two thumbs? What's going on? Let's get into it. We are getting into the world of science with Dr. Carl and Zoe Keane, who joins us. Zoe, how you doing?
Today, I'm doing really well.
Been a minute since we've had you on the show. Tell us, what has been kind of the big... You've been occupied, let's say that. You've had a lot that you've been working on.
I have. I've been through it since I saw you last.
Yeah. What? Give us a quick little Cliff's Notes of what you've been doing.
I think last time I saw you, I was maybe like one or two chapters through writing the manuscript for my first ever book, which was terrifying. And I didn't know whether I was going to be able to do it. I didn't know whether I was going to be able to finish it, but I was enjoying the process. And now it's completely finished. It's completely edited. And I'm actually up in Sydney for my first ever book event, even though it's not quite out yet. But I got to meet some booksellers last night.
And, okay.
You know, talk to them. Booksellers, I didn't know what they were, but they're people who sell books in bookshops and people who own bookshops. And I got to talk to them about my work, which
and
is really cool.
Do we have a cover yet? That's what I want to know.
We do. So I know what it looks like and it's going to be announced imminently, but I can give you a little hint about what's going to be on the cover.
Please.
So I've actually brought in a prop. This is a piece of art that I made based on my cover. And for those people listening, it's a print of a little shark. And so even though the book is about humans, I kind of used Australian nature as, I guess, like, this is a bit, maybe a bit wanky, but like as my muse. And for the sleep chapter, I started with sharks. And I went to a shark laboratory, a shark physiology laboratory in Townsville, where I met these epaulette sharks, which are these walking sharks. They can go out of the water and walk around when, you know, like go to different tide pools or walk over exposed corals at low tide. And the researchers had them in this facility and were trying to study them. But the problem was they kept sleeping in the daytime. And that's no good if you're trying to do kind of a 9-to-5 research, job. And so they tried to break that circadian rhythm and get them to, you know, be awake during the daytime. And it just didn't happen. They are absolutely nocturnal creatures and they want to snooze during the day. And so I was drawn there first because, hang on a second, do sharks even sleep? I thought they didn't sleep. What's going on here? And that was how I launched into that chapter. And it's the little epaulette sharks. Edna the epaulette is on the cover. So she's one of the sharks that I met at that facility.
You know what? I think the last time you were on Science with Dr. Carl, I think you had just been to that facility and you answered a couple of questions about sharks. What else do you reckon you could speak to this morning? What are some of the topics that have been on your mind recently?
Well, in the book, I talk about evolution. So it's life's big questions. Why are we like this? So why do we sleep? Why do we have pleasure? Why do we have sex? Why do we, you know, get things that are tricky like cancer? Why have we evolved, you know, for this long on Earth and diseases like cancer can still wipe us out? That's weird, right? You'd think that we would have evolved defenses against them. We have, but, you know, sometimes cancer's pretty tricky. It gets through. Why do we age? Why do we drink? So I've tackled those kind of questions and looked at animals like whales or Tasmanian devils, lots of really cool Australian animals to answer these questions, as well as animals that live outside of Australia. So I went down a whole chimpanzee rabbit hole, which was very exciting. You know, chimpanzees and their, you know, romantic relationships, bonobos, you know, a little bit of everything. So, but environment, evolution, ecology. I'm from Lutruwita, Tasmania, so especially if it's an environmental question from a cold and chilly place, I'm especially keen to answer it.
Okay, 0439757555. Someone who's also been on that book promo cycle, Dr. Carl is with us. Now, Carl, you're in New York at the moment. You're dialing in. Can you tell us anything from your week? In fact, I think you've been maybe getting into a bit of astronomy. What's going on?
I was trying to get into Manhattan Henge. So Stonehenge refers to some tall rocks in the United Kingdom that were started about 5,000 years ago and took about 1,500 years to finish. And on the solstice, the longest day of the year, the beam of the sun lines up a whole bunch of rocks and you can say, hooray, the seasons are now going to change. Let's sacrifice a fattened soybean or something to the great god of the changing of the seasons. And with regard to Manhattan, you have the same thing happening there. But the first thing to realize is that, you know how people say that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? You've heard them say that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true 2 days of the year. The other 363 days of the year, it's a little bit north or south, so it shifts all the time. And so in the case of Manhattan, the grid was set up in 1808, and the person who designed it was a 20-year-old chief surveyor of New York. And he set it up with about 220 streets going roughly east-west, or, you know, east-west, and then about a dozen avenues much bigger going north-south. They're actually tilted by about 30 degrees. So last Friday was when I could see the beam of light coming down. And if it had worked, it would have been perfect because I was at the end of 23rd Avenue. And when he designed it, this 20-year-old, he made sure that they all went onto the Hudson River. And so what you got is the horizon. So you can be in one of the big cities in the world, New York, and you can see the horizon because you've got the river, then you've got New Jersey. And the second thing is you've got this massive canyon of buildings. And when the setting sun does appear there, in my case, there's a cloud in the way, but when it does, the ball of the sun exactly fills a gap at the end of the streets. And we had a good talk about something else. But the thing is, it's like an eclipse. If you don't go there, you'll never see it. If you do, you might be lucky.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And then that pesky little cloud got in the way. God damn. Well, either way, we've got a lot of ground to cover. 0439 757 555. Let's get to the audience. We got Lauren in Cronulla. Now, Lauren, something happened the other day. Talk us through it.
Hi, doctor. So nice to be on. I love you, Dr. Carl. Hi. So the other day I had a pair of latex gloves on and I stuck one of my hands into a sink that had some hot water with some mineral turpentine in it. And I noticed that the longer I left my hand with the glove on in it, the glove expanded to about probably three times its original size. And I was just wondering why that happened.
Yeah. Ah, two things to realize. First thing is that you keep on hearing people talk about chemicals called polymers, and they're in plastic and they're in latex gloves, and they're kind of like a whole bunch of barbed wire strands sort of entangled with each other. And in the really, really cheap plastics that you sometimes get from the supermarkets, there's bits of a gap, and so you can put that bit of meat that you got from the supermarket in the fridge and the water will go through the little holes. Latex gloves have got much more overlapping, but they've got these polymers. Now, these polymers do not dissolve in water, and neither does turpentine. And so they can, you know, like dissolves like. So the turpentine absorbs into the gaps between the polymer and then pushes it apart. And 3-1, I'm very impressed you managed to get that much, Lauren. That's the best I've ever seen. You must have been doing a bit of a science experiment. Good on you.
Yeah, I definitely was. I was so curious when it happened. I was like, oh my God.
When you say bigger, was it just kind of falling off your hand?
It was seriously like it fit my hand perfectly. And then by the time it had finished growing, my fingers didn't even go up into the finger bits. It was just in the hand part of it.
You got me thinking about condoms. because obviously you couldn't use something like that is going to expand like this and fall off for condoms. And I was researching the invention of condoms at the start of the week for a story I'm writing on an archaeological dig in Tasmania. The archaeological dig's in Hobart at a pub. And it is looking at this kind of what fell through the floorboards between 1826 and 1880. So rubber, which is used for condoms, was invented in the 1840s, and then condoms were invented, you know, I think it was maybe 11 years after, so they were pretty quick onto it. And in this archaeological dig, they found what is either a condom or potentially a diaphragm from this era, and which is just amazing to think of these people back in the day, you know, before 1880, having a great time at the pub and then their condom falling between the floorboards.
Yeah.
And only to be discovered by archaeologists who are chuckling and blushing about it in the 2020s. So not super relevant to your scientific question, but it just got me thinking about how these amazing stretchy materials have changed our life and how important it is to sometimes have that snug fit.
And wait, and you know, the type of fit that you need for the body part or the task. Dr. Carl?
Well, my story about the condoms is that they were, the first written record we have is that they were invented by Dr. Fallopius, famous for the fallopian tubes, shortly after various diseases like syphilis started appearing in Europe. And so he made some out of the outer lining of the gut of sheep and gave them to a whole bunch of men who were going to have sex in brothels anyway. And he got them to have sex with women who did or did not have syphilis. And he did a double-blind thingy, not double-blind thing, but he did a bit of a control. And the condom worked in stopping syphilis. So that was the first sort of study on condoms way back then.
Wow. Okay. I feel like we've already covered so much in this one break. Gonzo has texted in saying, walking sharks, I'm out. We've got Shane right here. Shane, where are you from?
I'm from Tugan in Queensland.
Oh, fabulous. What's your question?
My question is when we die, are our bodies toxic to the environment? And if we are, would it be better to bury ourselves or to be cremated?
This is a great question. And it can depend on what drugs you're taking when you die. Because, of course, and like this often means, you know, therapeutical drugs, because often we're very unwell when we approach the time that we die. And a lot of the drugs that we take to keep us going and improve quality of life can actually be toxic for the environment. So that is one thing to take into consideration. That's something that can then leach into the soil, things like chemo drugs. And so that's one thing that can really change the game as to how toxic our bodies are for the environment when we die. And there are a lot of you know, graveyards that are taking this into consideration now and trying to put in place things that could, you know, help our bodies enter the earth in a softer way. So I actually visited a cemetery in Victoria once where instead of, you know, you could just be buried in a very traditional plot or you could be buried in a forest. And when you were buried in the forest, you weren't buried in a really, you know, hard coffin. I assume you'd have a softer coffin and then have a tree planted above you. So then you're already getting the, you know, microorganisms and all the, you know, worms and stuff that help decompose you and return you to the soil. They're having an easier time going to find you. But also then you've got a tree that is able to use your nutrients to grow. But the other thing that can make your body a bit toxic is the things that we use to preserve your body for funerals as well. So that can make your body's toxic.
Wow.
So yeah, there are a few ways that your body can be bad for the environment when you go, but there's also some really exciting ways that people are trying to create more environmentally friendly options. And this new place just opened in Hobart where you can get what's called a water cremation. And a water cremation is a really interesting thing. Instead of being cremated with really, really high temperatures, so when you get cremated now, you're in a coffin and you're blasted with incredibly high temperatures, and that takes up a lot of CO2 and also means that, you know, some slightly bad things for the environment, gases go up into the atmosphere. So it's not really great as an environmental option either. But with this, you're in pretty hot, but not as hot water, which has got an alkaline in it, and it essentially dissolves your body over a few hours. And you're left with just the bones. And then they pulverize the bones, and it looks just like ashes when you get it at the end of the at the end of the session. And so you're left with a very similar product, but it's a kind of softer and more environmentally friendly way to go. And it's just opened up in Hobart, so I assume there's going to be more opening up around the country. So I think as people start to think about environmentally friendly ways to go, we're going to see more of these. But there's one issue with this. It is, do you consider yourself basic or do you want to be basic?
Like a basic bee?
Yeah.
Yes and no, depends.
So,
why?
You know how things can be acidic or they can be basic?
Yeah.
You're in an alkaline solution and that's basic, so it's a really basic way to go. I'm sorry about that.
The basic B of cremation. I love that. Shane, thanks for your question.
No, thank you. It sounds like I'm going to go for the water, I think.
Yeah.
So, Pat, awesome.
So Shane, you are basic as hell. So we got, we got Pat in Oran Park here. Now, Pat, you got a question about the flu, which a lot of people have been tackling this winter season. What's going on?
Yes, good morning, doctors. My question is, when we do get the flu or COVID or something like this and then we start getting better, is that the virus at that point doing its job and dying off, or is that your body's immune system picking up the slack and finally kicking into gear? And then what's the likelihood of getting or contracting, say, the same virus within a week or two of getting better the first time?
Ah, a whole bunch of issues there. So firstly, we're talking about antibodies. So antibodies are chemicals that look like the letter Y. And the open jaw of the Y has little dents on it. And if it fits exactly onto the measles or influenza virus, then the tail of the Y will light up, and then along will come a cell called a macrophage and destroy them both. So you've got different types of antibodies. There's five major types, G, A, M, D, and E. And as soon as you get infected with anything, you start making some antibodies of one class really quickly, and they fade away. But in the background, your body is saying, the immune system is saying, okay, this guy's a baddie, let's get ready for him next time. And by the way, if it happens to come, say, roughly 2 weeks, you'll have a whole bunch that'll come charging out and will stay there for a long time. So you could have a flu and it'll go away. And then if you get another dose of the same flu within that first week, you haven't got the long-term antibodies ready to charge out. So it's your antibodies that knock off the virus. And by the way, 20% of people are naturally immune to COVID. And you're thinking, what? Well, think about smallpox in the old days. When it came into a village, it would kill 30% of everybody. But 70% would survive. Why? Because they had a different immune system. So I'll just finish off by saying that with measles, if you get measles, it turns out that in many cases, it wipes the memory of all your vaccinations and everything you've been immunized against in the past and everything that you've picked up by accident, and you've built up a natural immunity. And we've discovered now people who have been immunized against things get measles because they didn't get immunized against measles, and then suddenly they get all the diseases they were previously immunized against, and when we check, they don't have the antibodies against them anymore. So get vaccinated.
Hectic. Thanks, Pat.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
We've got Riley in Wollongong here. Riley, what do you want to know?
Hey, doctors. I have a bit of an evolution question, and it's like, what brain size or level of complexity is needed for a species to gain, I guess, what we call consciousness or free will? And considering that we're the only species that we've ever known to do it, do you think it's possible for it to happen again on Earth from evolution?
I love this question, and it's a super controversial one. So I mentioned at the start of our chat that I have just finished writing a book, and this is the final chapter of my book, Why Are We Conscious? And the thing is that the research community is completely divided on what we need to become conscious. And for this reason, it's called the hard problem of consciousness. So researchers will say, oh, that's the hard problem. And the problem is, we can self-report to each other that we're conscious. I can say, I'm conscious, Lucy, are you conscious? Hey, are you conscious calling in? But we can't ask our dog that. We can't ask a jellyfish that and really trust their answer. We can only really know our own experience. And so it can be very hard to tell. And I think that the theories of consciousness kind of go into like two main categories. There's the very restrictive theories of consciousness. So some people will say you need to have language before you can be conscious because you need to, you know, frame your thoughts around language. Now, the fact that some people don't have inner monologues to me makes this idea maybe not super credible, but credible scientists really, you know, believe it. Mm. Other kind of these, you know, really hard bars to reach are that you've got the cortex. So, you know, if you think of